I will be your chair for this next session, session four. However, before we get started with the session, just a couple of matters of general housekeeping. Now, first of all, if you would like to ask a question of the presenter, you can do so by using the chat button or the Q&A button on the top right of your screen. Your question will come through to me, and then I'll put it through to the presenter at the most appropriate time. The second item I'd like to mention is the importance of the feedback survey. Now, if you can kindly take a moment at the conclusion of the presentation for this session to complete the survey, your feedback you provide us is quite important in terms of planning future events. Now, moving on with the topic for this session is SMSF deeds, practically a trust deed. Now, when I think of SMSF trust deeds, I think of the governing rules of an SMSF. Quite an important document and something that you need to read. Read the deed, as the saying goes. But it surprises me how often a lot of people that I talk to are not familiar with their clients' SMSF deeds. And this can result in possible problems down the track. And a lot of people just simply assume that, well, they're all the same, they've got the same provisions. What do I need to read every person's SMSF deed? And the answer to that is they're not. Every solicitor, every SMSF provider has their own version of the SMS deed, and they are different. So you really need to read the deed for each SMSF client. Now, our speaker today is Daniel Butler from DBA Lawyers, and I'd now like to invite Daniel to commence his presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick, and welcome on board, everyone. Read the deed. And it's highly recommended you do read the deed. As Nick said, deeds are not a standard commodity. Indeed, when we start looking at things like discretionary trust deed or unit trust deed, one would think they're fairly stock standard. Well, the High Court said in CPT Custodians, there's no such thing as a standard normative deed. It depends on the particular wording. So look, an interesting topic because I admit I've been in this trade now for a long time. I've been drafting deeds for now coming on 40 years. I'm still drafting deeds and amending deeds. Even, you know, as we speak, we're doing amendments every day here at DBA Lawyers. And I suppose I could put up my hand and say I was the one who started a specific SMSF deed. So I drafted a deed back in the early 90s, where the deed back then for a super fund, it said, if you've got more than 300 members, you do this. If you've got more than 50 members, you do this. But back then we had the excluded fund members, member deeds, and I designed a deed which was specific to an SMSF. And that deed is still what I would say is, you know, still the best deed in the country. So I've been doing this for a while and I'm doing this with experience of more than 40 years. So I'm hoping today to pass on all that experience. And we're covering things like supplier. Who do you use? The importance of the deed history. Like, you know, the house depends on good foundations. So does the deed. We'll look at some, you know, common problems, some traps. We'll look at some key provisions, you know, what really determines a good deed and what should be in certain deeds. We'll look at a change of trustee. In a DBA, we do a whole wide range of documents. We upgrade deeds, but look, with change of trustees, there's quite a bit involved. In fact, I think the pricing of a change of trustee should be a lot higher than where it is, but it's a competitive market. So even a firm like ours, and we have lawyers drafting our deeds, not just put some information in the computer and you get the document straight back, doubt whether there's any lawyer, you know, review there. We actually have lawyers drafting them, and they're quite a complex document, a change of trustee. When to vary, and electronic execution. Talk about those things as well. And we'll just touch on that, you know, touchy subject. You know, should advisors be doing this sort of work? That's just to let you know where the risks are, because a lot of these systems today, they'll supply a document or they'll supply a template, and the advisor invariably is going in to work on that document. So it is the advisor who's really doing the drafting, and is that advisor, you know, really complicit in legal work, which we'll talk about, because certain things advisors who are not qualified can do and certain things that they are at risk. And we'll look at questions. As Nick said, I'm happy to take questions. Please load your questions. Nick is going to be monitoring questions and I'll stop at junctures, but you know, my goal is to get through the material today and give question time at the end as well. So let's get on to supplier and quality. For me, I like quality. Quality lasts. Might be cheap today, but might be costly tomorrow. So how do we determine who we use? One, I'd like to know they're qualified, they're skilled. It's not just printing off a document or producing a document without qualified people behind it, because that could be dangerous. I'd like to know they provide technical and ongoing support. They're in that area. This is a core activity. You know, they're writing newsletters that are worthwhile. They're presenting on the topics. They're easy to use. You know, they've got a web portal, fair enough. But if they've got a web portal, it's not too easy that you put the data in, it's coming straight back to you. Price, well, look, a firm like ours, we're not out there to be the cheapest, but I think price, if you're driven by price, there'll always be someone cheaper. So I would not use price as a determinative factor. Who prepares the documents? Is it the supplier or the user? So these are things that, is it a lawyer behind the system that's actually reviewing or providing any input? I think that does make a difference because it's then protecting the advisor. Ongoing service. Do they have other ongoing services? Like there are some that do automated document updates every year. That can be worthwhile, but is it necessary? And again, on quality. So these factors that you could weigh up, make your decision. Are you on the right supplier? Should you be looking elsewhere? So quality, we're looking at qualifications, technical and ongoing support. We want to know they're properly insured. The document will be clear, concise, and effective in court. A lot of people say their documents are simple. But we've seen quite a number of suppliers, they say they're simple and easy, but very complicated to actually construe and work out what they're getting at. Can you get a tailored document, you know, like a change of trustee? Like our change of trustee is highly tailored to the specific nature of what we're dealing with. The drafting style, will that cover changes or is it sort of really prescriptive and therefore will easily be outdated? And if you do get it straight from a lawyer, you do get the protection of legal professional privilege. If it's not from a lawyer, others can access that document. So just drilling down on some of these points, quality versus price and ease of use. What is more important? What, because we have some people, they just want to make it easy in life. That is, they put in the computer, that's easy. They get the document back straight away. That's what some people's goals might be, but you've got to think it from the client's perspective. As an advisor, you are implicitly saying the document you put in front of a client or recommend for a client is fit for use. And just touching on that point, have you ever stopped to read the deed? Does it make sense? Do you understand the key components? Because a trustee's most fundamental duty is to understand that deed and to abide by that deed. And here's a federal court and a high court judgment that the deed is key. And that is a fundamental duty of a trustee. As mentioned, advisors should be comfortable putting this document in front of the client to say this is fit for purpose. Have you checked whether your supplier has got PI? Have you checked whether they are qualified? And if they do say they have lawyer sign-off, what sort of lawyer sign-off are they talking about? Because that's very misrepresented. If it's not coming from a law firm, one, you do not have lawyer sign-off. Some suppliers say that you can pay extra to have lawyer sign-off, but that is often very limited sign-off that you are getting. So it's very misconstrued what this lawyer sign-off is. If you're getting it direct from a law firm, you are on far more solid grounds on that point. So if, for instance, as an advisor, you are obtaining a deed from a non-qualified supplier, the advisor does accept the risk. Because as a non-qualified supplier, you are accepting the risk of what comes with that. And therefore, you are not protected as you would be if you were also getting that from a law firm. Because a law firm, they have compulsory insurance. With a non-qualified supplier, there's no need for compulsory insurance, nor are they subject to any ethics or any other professional obligations that professionals such as lawyers are. And therefore, you as an advisor, particularly if you are using a template document and you are inserting the details, you are accelerating the risk that you are accepting by using that form of supplier. So the other interesting point is, and this comes out quite often when I go to clients, because I say, why should they use a law firm like ours? Because as I said, we're not cheap, we're good. But when I say we're not cheap, I think we are, and other lawyers as well. I'm not here to sell our services today. I'm here to educate. But a lot of people don't realize that going to a law firm, you're getting PI cover, you're having a lawyer behind it, you are minimizing your risk, because without that, you are taking that extra risk. And if you do look at these non-qualified suppliers, read the T's and C's. You know, often they say, we only supply documents. You must get your own legal sign off and review because you're on your own. You know, we more or less cast you to the wind. So be very careful to examine those finer terms, conditions. And I've seen a number of websites that say, legal documents, but when you read the T's and C's, they say these are not legal documents. All of the risk is on you. We have not considered your particular circumstances. You must get your own legal sign off and review. So if you follow the T's and C's of these non-qualified suppliers and you needed legal sign off, invariably you'll be paying more and with generally an inferior service. As mentioned, that term lawyer sign-off, it is bandied around. It is often misrepresented. What is a lawyer reviewing and approving, and what skill level does a lawyer have? And more to the point, if you put the data in and you get documents straight away, do you think a lawyer's really put any input to that document? Or was it a master precedent that was signed off? And if that master precedent was signed off, when was it signed off? Has it been updated? And what was the skill level of the lawyer, if any, input into that document? So these things are, it's an unregulated market. It's only you who can really judge whether or not you are getting misrepresented and whether you are getting quality. But as mentioned, you putting forward your choice of supplier to the client is saying, we're good for it. We're backing it. We're implicitly putting our PI and our reputation on the line because we've recommended that implicitly or expressly to the client. Now, here's a case. It was just reading between the lines, it was probably a change of trustee. It was a change of trustee prepared by an accounting firm. That's what we don't get told everything in the facts of a judgment, but reading between the lines, here was a case where the superannuation death benefit either went to second spouse or natural children of the deceased. And it appears, as mentioned, it appears that, I'll just go forward. It appears that at this time, this deed was prepared by the advisor. It appears that it would have been a cheap deed. In fact, my judgment was probably just over $100, if that. And however, that deed prepared by the advisor resulted in the second spouse taking the money. So this deed, which was a change of trustee, had the, you know, when the accountant was doing this, when they ordered it from the web, when they ordered it from this non-qualified supplier, when they might have been focused on getting a cheap deed, did they consider this would be a contested matter costing potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars and the super benefit ending up with a second spouse when the deceased had in mind the natural children would have got something? I think that's quite tragic. So that's, you know, that's one of the consequences. And we've got many more, which we will express through here. So as mentioned, the entire deed history is important. it's not just that top level deed. That top level deed is only as good as the foundation underneath it. Shaky foundations can result in costly, time consuming, and very stressful disputes that can split families apart. Even disputes involving lost and imperfect deeds are plentiful. And in fact, it was really interesting. Over the last 3 to 4 years, we've had so much litigation in this field on lost or imperfect deeds. Part of our business is a law firm serving SMSFs primarily. We do a lot of fix-up jobs. So we're doing a lot of fix-up, a lot of rectification, a lot of deeds of confirmation. And that sort of work is really hard to get these days. There's very few suppliers, I should say very few qualified suppliers, capable of doing that work. And as we know, some clients come in, they've got 6 or 7, maybe 12 documents that represent the deed. I am using that term, the deed, in a general sense. Nick did allude to the term before, governing rules. And I'll just give a quick one on that different, you know, the difference in those two terms. The deed is often a deed, and these days it's very popular that the deed adopts the governing rules. And the governing rules is normally, you know, that bulky document behind the deed, which has a contents page, which goes through the detail of those rules. But when you start with an original deed and you then vary and you take out the old deed, then you're left with the new deed, but the old deed is still part of the document trail because it's building, building from one level to the next. So we've got 12 documents. We've built our foundation of the governing rules throughout, or the deed overall as varied. And if there's one little chink in the armory of those 12 documents, that's where things might come unstuck. That's the sort of challenges that you might face in a litigation matter, dispute with the ATO, a family law dispute, a falling out between members, and so on. Particularly the death benefit disputes can be very involved, protracted, costly, stressful, and rip apart families. So it is worthwhile where you have clients which come in with a range of documents to at least put them on notice to say, look, to make sure you've got a complete document trail with none of those imperfections which could cause issues down the track, particularly if there's blended families, potential for disputes, which is only increasing in this world, to have that checked out. Now, you may not yourself be qualified to do that, but you can find a firm which could then review the documents and give feedback on those documents. So, look, invariably, that is a worthwhile service. Why is it a worthwhile service? Well, look, if you get it done now, you may be able to tie down the loose ends. If it's left until later and there's a death or a dispute, then that could add substantially to the costs, the time, and the uncertainty. So better to deal with these issues now, bring it forward, than leaving it and kicking it down the road. You will see in the notes, I've given you links to articles, articles and to other information, which you can do in your own time. So I've tried to make this more fuller than this presentation by giving you access to further information. So BDBNs especially depend on the integrity of that full document trail. We've seen numerous cases where the document trail is being ripped apart, scrutinized. So all deeds, rules, change of trustees must be validly prepared, witnessed, and executed, and the original versions must be available. Now, not everyone has the originals available, but there's even more to it than that. And as mentioned, all variations must have complied with the variation clause. Now, there invariably what we find is some of the issues haven't been properly finalized, and it might be that some special person or entity like an employer or a principal employer may have their consent may have been required. So if that's not available, that deed might be a nil event, and therefore subsequent deeds itself, it might be the house of cards. The house of cards falls down because one little chink in the armor falls apart, and then you strip away the deeds which are subsequently invalid. So you got to keep an eye on these things. But it's worthwhile having these checks done just to make sure you have it covered. Otherwise, the deed that you could be relying upon could be of no effect. no effect, no moment. It could be invalid, it could be ineffective. So BDBNs, binding death benefit nominations, and other strategies undertaken on flawed documents may be rendered invalid or easily challenged. As I said, the costs in a dispute of going through a proper document trial could be huge. I've been in family law disputes where I've been in court for days on end disputing the documents of what are the valid documents, who was the trustee, and so on. Here's a recent case. This is a recent case, Alicel. And in Alicel, this really brings out this point. Here, the deceased had made a BDBN, but there were various deficiencies in the document trail, including lost deeds and lost change of trustee documents. And due to the deficiencies, this trustee went to court, and the trustee went to court so that it could actually confirm whether the trustee was validly acting. So that alone was in issue. Also, which set of governing rules constituted the current governing rules of the fund, and whether indeed the trustee could treat the BDBN as valid. So in this case, there was doubt. This trustee went to court on a proactive basis, and that was a quite appropriate thing to do. And if they do it in quite an appropriate thing to do, those costs or a considerable amount of those costs can be picked up by the trustee of the fund. So it is a valid exercise of the trustee's discretion or duties in order to do that. And it's quite a prudent thing, because there have been cases where there has been doubt. Trustees haven't taken the initiative to go to court to get clarification or direction, and have been worse off by a long shot. So you may say, look, Dan, that's not a problem. You know, a lot of our clients got problems. What sort of problems can really come home to bite? And here's another range of decisions which involve SMSFs and trusts, which just bring out this point about problematic deed histories. And here's one, the first point here, Ray Naramon. And in this case, the description of the person signing as authorized representative rendered that deed, which was a deed in the chain, that document was rendered invalid because they described that person as an authorized representative rather than a director or secretary in accordance with the Corps Act Section 127. Here was a case that the best evidence they had was an unexecuted version of a deed. And therefore, they went to court to say, this was the best evidence. Please give us a declaration, court, that can act on this unexecuted deed. And here's a case where the bank in Sutton, the bank said, oh, look, you don't have the original. You only have a copy. We want to see the original, or have a court declare that that is the best evidence, and then we can act on that. So we've seen a number of situations where banks have insisted on the original deed. Here's another one, Montevani and Vanta. This is the original decision in 221. Justice McMillan of the Victorian Supreme Court held that the trust did not exist. They had the schedule. They had the schedule to the trust deed. And she initially came to the view there was no trust. Without the governing rules, how can you have a trust? On appeal to the Court of Appeal, there was held to be a valid trust, but that was not the end of the matter. The case was then ongoing in respect of, well, now that we have a trust, we now have to sort out what are the governing rules. And not only that, in addition to sorting out what the rules are that we're meant to be bound by, we also have to sort out who the trustee is. And there was a dispute between warring family members, which would have really taken that matter far more. We haven't got any further on that that litigation, but that appeal decision has been heard. There is a trust. And it just shows you how not having a perfect deed can be quite costly. Here's another one, Barry McMahon nominees. In this case, there was an application. There was a lost deed. The applicant went to court, and the court said, hey, Look, can you please go back and do your homework correctly? You haven't delivered up the evidence we'd like to see to give a declaration. So watch out, because you might go to court and then come off worse because you've wasted time and money. So when you go to court, make sure you do your homework and get the evidence which the court will demand. So look, there's plenty of these common problems and traps. And we look at Worcester and Morris. Worcester and Morris dispute over a BDBN. The BDBN was ultimately held to be valid. So the BDBN was valid. However, the trustees said, I don't wish to respect that. And that was the second spouse. So the second spouse said, I'm not going to respect that BDBN. There is the Supreme Court. Take it on to the Supreme Court. You spend the money. In 1 year alone, the legal costs hitting the deceased account was close to $350,000. And I believe the $350,000 together with accounting fees, but I think the accounting fees were about $40,000+, and the lawyers got over $300,000 1 year. Now, that litigation went further and further, but there was a BDBN. The deed was part of the question, and how the BDBN was drafted was also part of the question. So this case really brings out you need good provisions on succession to control. So it's not necessarily just the BDBN provisions, but the control provisions, because as noted, when a member dies, a number of deeds take that person out. So there's quite a number of deeds we review where on death, you're no longer counted. You don't have a legal personal representative represent you. You're just out. You're negated. So you're left in the wilderness, so as to speak. Better deeds do have someone. If you die, if you lose capacity, they have someone who can step in the shoes of that person and represent their interests, as you would expect, but not all deeds do that. We have another case, Munro and Munro. And in this case, we have the situation of a BDBN was rendered invalid because the client, who was a lawyer who used an accountant to draft the BDBN, put in trustee of deceased estate. So rather than putting in legal person representative as required by clause 31 of the deed and under CIS, they put in the wrong wording. And it was even argued, there's about five arguments put forward. Oh, we all know who the trustee of deceased estate is. It's the deceased estate who is really the LPR. However, that failed. So that failed. And that case was a remarkable case from the point of view of making sure you read the deed, and also when you're filling out the BDBN to follow the instructions in that BDBN, because that instruction to complete the words legal personal representative were even in that BDBN. So I might stop in a moment just for some questions and just see whether Nick has some questions for me, but I'll just also just touch on this case, which is the REST decision, which was in 2016, and this involved a very large industry fund. And the very large industry fund came to the view that the BDBN provisions in CIS were ambiguous, uncertain, with potentially unintended consequences and should be recast. Indeed, there is a movement now to have the BDBN CIS provisions recast. However, that has, you know, been on foot for a while, but there is a reinvigorated effort to get that recast after some recent reform measures put forward on those provisions. So these provisions have been somewhat uncertain, and it's just on this top point, many SMSF deeds still include the CIS provisions. So if you include the CIS provisions, either by express wording or even though you do not see them in the deed, be mindful they could still exist. A lot of deeds have what is called super deeds, I should say, a deeming provision. And the deeming provision includes the CIS provisions. And the CIS provisions are therefore part of the deed, even though you don't see them, as do certain trustee provisions. So there's certain provisions at law which are included in the deed, even though you do not see them in black and white. So what I'm saying is you need to be able to read the deed and if you do have a deed with CIS provisions governing the BDBN provisions, I would want that deed updated to a better deed, which we'll talk about in a moment. So, Nick, just over to you. Have you got any questions from listeners? Because we do want attendees out there to be engaged and to ask questions.
Thanks, Daniel. Look, no questions at this stage, but I must say I admire the fact that you can pronounce BDBN consistently. Bit of a tongue twister, that one.
Well,
Got a bit of a question from or more of an observation. You talked about SMSF deed history, and obviously it includes the original trust deed establishing the SMSF and deeds of variations and changed trust deeds and what have you. And I've got to say that my own experience has been that it's from some auditors that I've been liaising with, it's actually an audit requirement where they actually go back and request copies of all the deeds going all the way back to the establishment of the fund. And more often than not, you do find errors where it is possible that deed number three wasn't executed correctly, or the variation power wasn't exercised properly, or what have you. So it makes all the subsequent deeds technically ineffective, invalid. So I'm just sort of noticing, I don't know about you, have you seen the auditors, SMSF auditors, requesting copies of all deeds for review?
We have, and we see them stepping up what they're doing. You know, the ATO is putting pressure on the SMSF auditors, and SMSF auditors are being far more thorough. So we are, and it's a very good point. Like, they come back and question things about LRBAs, the limited recourse borrowing arrangements. They're questioning things about change of trustees. So I think it's wise for auditors to request a full document trail. I do find, however, it is unfortunate that auditors do carry too much responsibility, because how is an auditor meant to interpret and construe a deed? That's the job of a lawyer. And this is what I'm making the point. Who is qualified to provide this work, Nick? Lawyers are lawyers are qualified. That's who you go to for legal services. And therefore, what we have is the market has changed. The market has changed for, cheap, efficient supply of documents without really much lawyer involvement, if any. So that's where the markets move. The markets move to mass commodity without the tailored approach. Like, we would say, just as a guess, most deeds out there would be produced by non-qualified suppliers that are really of questionable quality. As I said, we've been in this business for long enough to know every year we're updating our deed. We review thousands of deeds, thousands upon thousands of deeds every year, both for updating and for providing opinions on, that we see the quality out there, and it really does surprise us. And we also see that a number of advisors are using very outdated documents.
The other thing too, Daniel, that sort of surprises me is for example, I mainly see this with accountants where they're quite happy to jump online to one of these service providers. They input the data, they get their deed, and essentially they're taking on, or their binding death benefit nomination, and essentially they're taking on this risk that they presumably don't have PI insurance cover for. And, all it takes is for something to go wrong, a dispute to happen either at family law or an estate dispute or something of that nature. The deed or the binding death benefit nomination is challenged. Goes back to who prepared it. It's an accountant. A claim is made, but the insurer may refuse cover.
Well, you're dead right. Using the word dead right. It really is interesting because this is another area I'm about to venture into, which I will do, where I think it really does give you a differentiating factor to good deed suppliers and then those that are really out there in the wild. So that's where I'm now going to go. And I really think this is a distinguishing factor because it really does hinge off the BDBN. And this is where I'm going now on this slide. We have seen a number of deeds that provide multiple options to the client. The options might include an SMSF will, a death benefit rule, a BDBN which is lapsing, or a BD band which is non-lapsing. These multiple options, in my view, are a recipe for disaster. Look at all the cases on BD bands. As a lawyer, I can only recommend you keep it simple. And as Nick said, most of our clients know that BD bands are dangerous. They are getting and assuming more risk if they do facilitate the BDBN. Even executing a BDBN is dangerous. So it really is best done by the client's estate planning lawyer, not by you. Sure, you can do it. I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm just saying, look, do you get paid anything extra? Have you got PI cover? Are you breaching legal practice provisions? Those are the sort of factors that should be going through your mind and your firm's mind when you or you are allowing your staff to undertake this activity. Now, let's just look at these multiple options. I'm not against doing an SMSF will. I'm not against doing a death benefit rule, but I would only recommend that be done by a very experienced lawyer who is expert in the area and also expert in estate planning. It is dangerous for advisors who are not qualified to get into that area. Even myself, highly qualified, 40 plus years experience in this trade, I've done some very, very novel and complex SMSF wills. I don't call them an SMSF will. That really is a marketing term which is meaningless, because what is an SMSF will? I don't know what an SMSF will is. The High Court certainly doesn't know what one is. I've got a lot of authority I can show you on BDBNs. We've now had since 1999, we've had over 20 years of authority built up and developed by case law all the way to the High Court. So the High Court has pronounced that a BDBN can last indefinitely, that a BDBN is a function of the deed, and an argument about an SMSF will was effectively rejected. So the High Court did not want to entertain an argument about an SMSF will. And I mentioned before, the High Court has previously in CPT Custodians said there's no such thing as a normative fixed meaning for a discretionary or unit trust. Indeed, there is no fixed or normative meaning for a BDBN, not even in the CIS legislation. The CIS legislation talks about a notice given to the trustee about a death benefit. There is no technical term BDBN. But with a BDBN, as I said, we're on a well-trodden path. We have plenty of litigation to guide us on what to do. And it's simple. Keep it simple. That's what most of our clients do, is use the BDBN template from our deed that comes with our documents. It's got a number of cascades. It's got an auto-reversionary option. It's very simple. And it can also get you across that issue of not only to who, but in what form, i.e. as a lump sum or a pension. And that was one of the real genesis for the concept of the marketing spin, which I will refer to as an SMSF will. So an SMSF will was dreamt up because it overcome some of the perceived limitations of a BDBN. In the early days, people perceived the BDBN was 3 years. People perceived it was to who, not also how. But as mentioned, we had that clarified by the High Court in 2022 for all Australian jurisdictions, that a BDBN can last indefinitely and it's a function of a deed. So you can also say not only to who, but how. Notwithstanding what I've just said, a number of these suppliers encourage you to get into these complex documents with multiple options, which is really a recipe for things going wrong. If we look at the simple cases of BDBNs, how many of those have hit the courts and how many are being dealt with on a day-to-day basis by law firms like ours and other advisors where things are in dispute, which are not reported. So as a lawyer, it does concern me. We have got to this poor quality of documents and issues that are out there, such as SMSF wills, unproven. I haven't yet, in all my experience, I've yet to be convinced of an SMSF will from another supplier that I've seen that actually works and got past our scrutiny. And I've told clients at times to go back and ask for your money. You've just got that deed, you've just got all that fancy work, but frankly, it doesn't work and you've been ripped off, and go back and ask for your money back. So if you do prepare those documents and your client then goes off to a lawyer or another advisor's, and they say you've been ripped off, that doesn't work, you've been sold a lemon, how would you feel? However, that still is going on today. So, as mentioned, most of our clients use a BDBN. It's simple, straightforward. You don't have to get too fancy with these things. If you do, as mentioned, please go to a lawyer with experience. Don't accept that risk. I think you're going into really high risk territory. As mentioned also, deeds need to be carefully reviewed. It's not just what's in writing, but it's also what is implied. Have a look at Donovan and Donovan. In Donovan and Donovan, it initially came to the view that the CIS provisions were implied and therefore the BDBN was limited to the three-year period. But that was a very early decision in case law. So my recommendation is if you look at your deed, have you got those multiple options? I'd be wanting to get it reviewed and revised. If you have a deed that still relies on the CIS provisions, I would want to have that reviewed and revised. Here's one other case that I'll just mention here. This Ipoly and Conti. And here was a case where the deceased spouse, Francesca, had made three BDBNs in favor of her long-term second spouse, Augusto, each of which had expired due to the three-year limit. Between the second and third BDBN, the deceased had also made a will directing her super to her daughters from the prior relationship and appointing her daughters as executors. So here's a pretty sad case. You would think that Francesca, who made three BDBNs in favor of her second spouse, but between the second and third, went off to a lawyer and got a will. One of the questions that I asked here was this Francesca, who was heavily involved with whatever, where Augusto was coming up to say, sign here, love, sign here, love. And Francesca's, lamb to the slaughter, she signs. And then witnesses are applied. I don't know, but that does suggest that Francesca may not have necessarily considered the BDBNs appropriately, but if she got her will done, she may have taken advice and she's got her daughters in. But her daughters said we should be then in there as trustee directors. However, the court held that no, the CIS provisions of trustees representing the members is permissive and it's not compulsory. And therefore, if you want someone to represent you when you lose capacity or you die, then you need the documents to achieve that. So you need to have the documents ready. You cannot just rely upon the white knight slipping into the shoes of that person. Here's another point, and it just brings home the seriousness of what we're dealing with. It's just the finest detail could make the deed invalid. Here was, and I just mentioned this before, it was in this decision, the misdescription of the signature was enough to make that deed invalid in re Narimon. And that was authorized rep instead of director/secretary. So that just failed. So we're now moving on to key provisions. And the key provisions that I see in a deed is here's a really important part. Going back before, the BDBN is important, but control to the decision-making of that fund is even at a higher level. So the question is, in your deed, when you got this scenario, second spouses, what takes priority? Is it the BDBN or is it the pension? So what do you think? And this is something as well that you should be on top of with your deeds. So we've got husband and wife. They're both directors of the trustee. They're both members. They're both 50-50 shareholders. Second relationship with different children. So what does a deed give priority to? Is it the BDBNs or the pensions? Because this has come around for a while. Because it could be that the pensions are auto-reversionary, but it could be that in this case, husband's had a relationship with a new de facto spouse and husband's now made a BDBN, which says, hey, my super's going to my de facto. rather than to his wife. So what would win out in this context? I'll just give you a moment to think about that. Well, let's go to what we see in deeds. Many deeds do not provide any guidance, thus costly disputes emerge. Some deeds provide the pension with priority. In contrast, some deeds provide priority to the BDBN. So what is the correct approach? Frankly, if you have one or the other and you have priority, then that is okay. But what we do find is often there is no priority or there is no guidance. In our experience, we have given priority to the BDBN. We believe over a lot of testing, a lot of experience, that that is the best way to go. And we have also put our pen to paper via this article where you can see our reasoning. We've supported by that by case law. We know that's not everyone's cup of tea, but it is by far the best way. We have seen cases where an expensive law firm has done the estate planning for a couple. Subsequent to the very expensive estate and thorough estate planning, they've gone to their accountant. Their accountant has dropped in a pension, and the pension has made it auto-reversionary without conferring to the client. In effect, under the deed, the priority was given to the pension. In that case, the accountant argued they did not give legal advice or legal service. However, the effect of putting in the auto-reversionary pension blew up the estate plans because it blew up the BDBN, which would have made a lot of difference to that couple. So you can see where I'm going. It's very important that you understand these complexities that you're dealing with and know what's in these documents. You cannot have that happen where a client's estate planning done by a law firm is blown apart by you putting in a pension because you might delegate that to a staff member who goes off to the system, produces a few documents, and it's all auto-done, auto-reversionary. Have you thought about the consequences? Another one I mentioned about provisions of legislation cutting through deeds and even common law provisions or common law points coming through deeds. Not everything is expressed in a deed. And here's a classic. In most jurisdictions, there is this prudent principle test for investments. We know about SIS. With SIS, as noted in this second bullet point, you must formulate, review regularly, and give effect to an investment strategy such as diversification, cash flow, liquidity, and insurance. Now, SMSF deeds often expressly reflect the SIS factors, but do they reflect the state or territory criteria? Generally, they do. So generally, they do also reflect the state or territory criteria unless expressly excluded. There are very few deeds that have come across in all my experience that do exclude those criteria. Now, believe it or not, the criteria, and I just checked myself in the Trustee Act of Victoria, Section 8, there's 15 discrete factors that a trustee under trust law should look at with each discrete investment at least once a year. Now, while we have to update our SIS investment strategy once a year or regularly review, have you thought about this being cut by a thousand swords by not having considered the 15 factors in respect of each discrete investment every year unless you have a deed which is appropriately drafted? However, I would say that is mainstream. As mentioned, there is cheap and there is quality. You can choose which you want. A change of trustee. Is that left to the last person standing that has the power? Like, let's say this second spouses. One loses capacity, one dies. Is it the surviving spouse that now has control? Can the members choose? And where the members can choose, if they're dead, do they have representation via their LPR, their attorney or their executor? That's what we want to see in a deed. And if the members can choose, is that based on the number of head or is that based on the majority account balance? These are all very important determining factors as to whether that is a balanced and fair deed. And as mentioned, there are many cases on change of trustees. As mentioned, a firm like ours, we're only charging a very low cost to do a change of trustee, but the risks there are quite high. Have a look at this, for instance. What mum and dad in a company, the shareholders hire and fire the directors based on the shares generally. If you've got 50-50, how can you vote in a director? You cannot. You can get a stalemate. Is there a chair? Like, it's quite inappropriate to have a chair in a mum and dad company, because who's a chair, especially if one loses capacity, especially if they're second spouses? However, in the model that we're suggesting is the members can hire and fire the trustee. Here, we would suggest, you know, we've had situations where the female member has come in, brought in 80% of the wealth. If that female member brings in 80% of the wealth, we think that that should be reflected in this appoint or power. So you need to work out, what is the appoint or power? The appoint or power to a discretionary trust is key. To a super fund, it is also key. Who has that appoint or power? Is it head or is it account balance? Is it fair? That's what you need to consider. Here's some further reading. So the appoint or role can vary. It could be members based on more than 50% account balance, or it could be something else. Some deeds depend on the majority of members. Some say it's three quarters. Just look at the deed, make sure you're comfortable, make sure you're getting it right. Another thing on that fine point, here's another case it goes down because of the description of the description was incorrect. Miss Moss signed the change of trustee as a member and not in her role as a founder. So not wearing the right cap when she applied the signature invalidated that change of trustee, which meant the control of that fund was in other hands. Now, I know I don't have a lot of time left, and Nick, I am quite keen, and for the audience out there, I hope you've been enjoying it, but I'm quite keen to listen to your questions, to respond to your questions. But I'll just go through the remaining part of the topic at a more higher level. But the question is often asked from us as to when to vary. And as a lawyer, we must act in the client's best interest. We're not just out there to promote our services. So we look at this independently over many years. What we have noticed is, well, there are major reforms in mid-2007. There are major reforms in mid-2017. And you might think that's a 10-year period. And we're now in 2024. That's about a 7-year period. But I think if firms want to establish what we might say as a fair and reasonable best type practice, we've normally come up with, you know, a 5-year cycle. So look, if you have a suite of deeds, we would generally recommend you consider a 5-year cycle. Now, when I say a 5-year cycle, that's on a quality deed. If it's not a quality deed supplier, and particularly if it's from an unqualified supplier, I would think that it would be wise to get that reviewed even more frequently than a 5-year cycle. Sure, our deeds can last 10, maybe longer, but it's an appropriate measure for the advisor to have a regular suite of up-to-date deeds. Two lines in the sand, 2007, 2017. So I'm saying, look, if you have a client with a deed prior to, say, mid-2017, I would consider having that reviewed and updated. There have been many changes since mid-2017. We're getting over that 5-year mark. It's getting on to 6-7 years. It's getting at that time where we should consider. We've got that Div 296. We've had so many other changes with pensions, with TBC, with total super balance. The total super balance is changing because of the Div 296 $3 million test. We have differences in release authorities, Division 293, Division 296. It just keeps changing. All the factors keep changing. The gainful employment changes. So there's so much change on an ongoing sense that generally a 5-year mark is where we have recommended where an update should be considered. You can also update on when you are considering a client, like they're coming to you for a pension, they're coming to you for estate planning. Those are good times to have a look at the deed, have a look at it, but firms are best having a regular update pattern so they know that at least their flock of funds have a regularly updated deed of a sufficient basis. The next question is, do you need to do it annually? Not necessarily, but there are annual services available out there, even a firm like ours. We provide one, we don't sell it, but clients do demand it. So if you want to be on an annual system, fine. Do you need to be? Not necessarily, but some firms do prefer it. Just some salient reminders on the homeward straight. before we open forum, and please log your questions. The more, the merrier. He is a very learned author, in fact, a very well esteemed author in Australia on deeds. And it really does come down to it. Deeds have historically been written in written form, not electronic. So when we look at e-execution, it does raise concerns from a legal perspective. Another point that we do see at times is with you know, these documents, 70 to 80 pages, we don't want to put everything in front of the client, just get them to sign the execution page. Is that good enough? Well, Seddon says, no, avoid that. Make sure you have the client has the full paper copy and signs the paper copy, preferably in wet ink. So on the execution point, my colleague Bryce Figot recently wrote a very good article which deals with this, and I thought, why trot it out differently? But here it is. We as a firm, even though there have been advances in technology, those advances in technology are qualified, as in you need to satisfy certain criteria for them to be valid. And for deeds, in contrast to other documents such as contracts, we would recommend the better policy being have deeds executed via wet ink with witnesses. That is the best practice. If you do vary from that, you are accepting risk. If it is, for instance, a company, we know that Section 110 of the Corps Act has been amended, and that will allow you to do it, but there are qualifications there. Certain Australian jurisdictions have it, but these days you don't know which jurisdiction will be litigated in, and therefore it's best to have a properly executed deed in the old traditional method. The next question I'm really going to touch on briefly, because I know you probably won't want to hear about this, but can advisors do these deed updates? I would say it's better to resist that temptation, even with a BDBN, as mentioned. Some non-qualified suppliers say that they have lawyer input. As I said, I'm quite skeptical at times. Here is the provision from the Legal Profession Uniform Law Application Act, which is now in Victoria, New South Wales, NWA. This is to protect consumers. And the penalty is 250 penalty units in Victoria. That sum, since that number down the bottom, is now close to $48,000 for a penalty if you are doing legal work and you get detected and fined. Not many people get detected and fined, but what is coming out in litigation? It is litigation like that Perry and Nicholson. The cheap deed off the web, that's subject to litigation. The advisor is now embroiled with a litigation case. They have to defend their position. They may be up for cost negligence. There's also the professional bodies that says stay away from legal work, such as CANS, the CANS and CPA. They say stay away from legal work. And there's this recent decision in New South Wales where an accountant who gave advice on duties, there's a dispute in an estate context where the executors did not want to pay Mr. Batten. They did not want to pay this Mr. Batten because they said he contravened the Legal Profession Uniform Act. Therefore, the estate does not pay. So if you want your fees, make sure you are doing what you're qualified to do. And insurance cover is also important. So you can also jeopardize your insurance cover if you are not sticking within the knitting and sticking within what you are qualified to do. And the most recent commentary before I finish is the TP, Tax Practitioners Board, which says, be careful if you're straying into legal territory of giving advice on state laws. So conclusions, quality counts, advisors should minimize their risks by not undertaking legal work and using deeds. They should be very careful of looking at their deeds with the document trail. If it's pre-2017, think about updating. Deed histories could be checked to fill up gaps. Avoid e-execution until it's safe to do so. And better stick to the well-trodden and tested path of BDBNs rather than the adventurous path of SMSF wills, especially if you are not qualified. And quality documents have value-added benefits and follow-on service and support. and having a lawyer in support should minimise risks moving forward. So finish the formal part there, Nick, and over to you.
Right, thanks for that, Dan. Look, we're just on 2:30, so we've got a couple of questions, but I might just get you, Dan, to have a look at those and provide your feedback sort of offline type of thing, because we've got to move on to the next session. So, Dan, I'd like to thank you for that presentation, giving us the benefit of your experience and over many years. Just want to remind delegates to complete the evaluation on the Attendee Hub. And the next session is session 5, Digital Assets in Operation, will be commencing shortly. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll get to those questions.